property for what I paid for. It was a very generous, very generous act. So now we had a parking lot. A few years later, the other piece of property facing Devonshire was available. We bought that. We had to go into court to get a variance, and our neighbors were fighting us. These days, not a week will go by that the neighbors won't call. May they use some of the spaces on the parking lot. But in 1956, they were fighting off-street parking. It seems rather funny, but that was the case. So we had parking, and it was much more than just a driveway. And without the parking, we don't have enough for major holy days, big bar mitzvahs, weddings, but we can't imagine what it would be like.
Without, otherwise.
Yes, yeah. Without that.
Yeah. That was a terrific break.
All right, so I will continue where I started with this. So all we had in the new building was a back door, because the architects just needed a back door so you could get to the driveway. But now we have a parking lot with 120 spaces, and people keep asking, with such a magnificent building, we just come in a back door, that's all it is. And they were quite correct, it was a back door. I didn't go into the history with everybody who inquired. Mr. Berkman, most generously, with Milton and Ruth Harris, provided us with a significant sum of money, and we built a back entrance, which was really worthy from the parking lot in the building, worthy of the grandeur of the rest of the building. Mr. Berkman was succeeded by Albert I. Raisman, also a life trustee who is still with us. I'm trying to think of what the dynamics were, because the years for the last two decades or so have been very dynamic years. And
Raisman?
Yes,
about
right.
About 1982 or 3 or something?
No. About 84 to 88. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying 80, no, it was to 1990, oh, no, no, to 80, to 86, I'm sorry, 82 to 86. Mm-hmm. And then Dr. Sidney Busis became president in 1986, and it was under his direction that this major restoration got started. He was very, very instrumental in helping to guide the fundraising for this project. I would say that's a major project of his tenure. And then in the winter of this year, 1990, Marvin M. Josephs became president.
Is there anything left for Marvin to do?
Well, to finish the fundraising, oh, there'll be things to do, but I advise him quietly, not on tape. There are always things to do. The nature, or the way in which Rod of Sholem is perceived in the Jewish community, has changed. I like to explore sociology, and for years, families would have their children come to Sunday school at Rod of Sholem so that their children could rub elbows with the socially elite. That has all changed. Conservative and Orthodox Jews in Pittsburgh have made it, as the Reform Jews had done several generations earlier, so that very few of them who are of a conservative or Orthodox bent are also going to join Rod of Sholem. So Rod of Sholem has a task of seeking members. It's my estimate that fewer than half the Jews of Pittsburgh are affiliated with a synagogue. The task of getting the unaffiliated to affiliate is a significant task of expanding the opportunities for the intermarried, the mixed married. There are many of them in our community. They should be able to find a place within the synagogue. It may have to be a liberal synagogue. It surely won't be Orthodox. And the conservatives seem to have mixed emotions, but liberal Jews can open their arms to couples like this, and especially try to get their children to get some Jewish religious training. There's much to be done.
There is some Jews. For example, I invited some Jews I knew who don't belong here to a dinner that was being held here. They wouldn't even come to that. They have nothing to do with any temple.
Well, of those who are unaffiliated, there is a hardcore, a minority of a minority, who will not have anything to do with anything that we would call formal Jewish religion. However, the majority of those who are unaffiliated may still become affiliated Jews at some time in their life. But an effort has to be made. In an earlier time, people just, as a matter of course, I don't mean this facetiously, in my family, my parents belonged to a synagogue, my grandparents belonged to a synagogue. As soon as I got married at age 25, my wife was 21, we belonged to a synagogue. When my kid brother came out of the service, he belonged to a synagogue. And I said, with us, especially with the males, you were circumcised on the eighth day, and you joined a synagogue when you were a family person.
It's interesting that we arrived at exactly where I had hoped we would, and to perhaps the most difficult part of this discussion, and sort of the end of our discussion. Rabbi...
Jacob?
No. My favorite philosophical writer, Borowitz.
Oh, Eugene Borowitz.
Eugene Borowitz has written recently that the liberal Jews of America have run out of Israel and liberalism and social interest as a basis or need or even ethnic basis for being and retaining Jewish identification. And there's no passion in that. Mostly we're passive. We have a passive interest in those things rather than the major active one. And that we have, if we're going to make it at all, going to have to become believers. I want to ask you a very difficult personal question. Personal question. What role has belief ever had in your life? And two, have you... Because you have and perhaps it's better addressed to a rabbi with respect to what do we feel is the belief evolution or change in the American Jews that we live with and encounter. If Borowitz is right,
I don't agree with Borowitz. I mean, I do know what it is that you're enunciating. What do I feel what might be? I have been here for 37 years, and I have been dealing with many passive Jews, but I've also been dealing with many warm, liberal Jews. It is not a matter of convenience. I've been dealing with people who worship. Maybe they should do it daily, but they surely do it weekly. There has been a coherent whole in liberal Judaism in America to which many of these people adhered. I believe that you still, or that we in liberal Judaism still can do it, to take certain things. I do not believe that a yarmulke and a tallis for a person of a liberal bent is going to make them some kind of a true believer. I know it wouldn't for me. It simply wouldn't for me. If you need these ornaments, and here I know I'm being demeaning and deprecating, but there are other synagogues for you. I cannot imagine that given modernity, that people are going to come back, they're going to give up their beliefs in their everyday life, in their professional careers, and suddenly put on certain adornments and become true believers. That orthodoxy may be growing, good, I'm all for that. But it's growing not from taking liberal and reformed Jews and turning them to orthodox Jews. It's taking people who grew up in an orthodox environment, who got rid of all that and now want to come back. I think that's healthy. In my own case, well, I have to cite something. Freehoff will say, and I find myself getting into the habit, when I say goodbye, I could say, Harold and Howard, if we have to meet again, it can be next Thursday, God willing. I say it. I know it's easy for me just to say it, but it does mean something. Friedhoff always said it, and friends of mine or people who got close to me with a wink would want to know, if I'm that close to Solon B. Friedhoff, he really doesn't believe in God, right? It's all a facade. I said, no, he really does believe in God. When he says God willing, what his beliefs would be or what his God would be, I can't say. But there is always the unknown, and he would say God willing. In my own case, I'm a terrible blasphemer. I understand all of that. But I do believe in God. I can't define for you just what my God is. But when I'm pushed to the wall and I say I believe in God and somebody wants proof, what I say is, if the Jewish people has survived this many millennia, there has to be a God. He taunts us and does all the rest of the nasty stuff. Nonetheless, I cannot believe that the Jewish people could have survived. To me, that's the greatest single bit of evidence. Whether it's Orthodox, whether it's Hasidic within Orthodoxy, conservative, Reconstructionist, liberal, Reform, to me, that's the proof.
It's interesting that you would pick that as the proof. It's a very important one from our perspective. Most liberal Jews take a different basis for belief, including myself in that. But of course, that if you hadn't said it that way, that would have been the follow-up question. In other words, if you believe in God because there's a world, that's a good answer. But then again, why Jews?
Well, that's my answer.
That's your answer to both.
That's my answer.
To both. That's very good. I appreciate that. It's interesting also that you feel that you can take it, honestly seem to take exception to Borowitz's...
I just don't think that that's going to do it. I don't find that much passion, maybe in a nightclub, but I just don't believe that the majority of modern Jews... going to find that passion. I go to weddings now, and the couple are raised on chairs, and I ask people with me, do you know what that is? Well, it's part of a Jewish ceremony. I said, no, that's not what it is. Do you know, I said at Rosh Hashanah, that 35 years ago, they never would do this? Do you know when this started? They look at me. I said, this is a Hasidic thing. Men and women don't touch. That's why there's also a handkerchief. To us, it means absolutely nothing. It's just fun. So that many of these things...
Passion. Fun. What? Fun. That's a word of passion, isn't it?
Yes. So what I'm saying is that that's been introduced. I agree to that. However, in terms of is there going to be any form of worship, or are we just going to go to weddings, watch a couple hold handkerchiefs, and dance the Hora? Yes, there will be the fun elements, what I call out of nightclubs, but I do believe that there's going to have to be some theology, whatever the core was, with modification, it will have to be. Or else, well, we can be a social club, no reason why people won't pay money to belong to a social club, but I don't think it'll be Judaism.
Well, incidentally, I think now you're agreeing with... Borowitz. Borowitz says there has to be some theology. Those were your words.
Yes.
And that's what he is, remember?
Yes.
That's really what he's referring to. I'm surprised that your denigration of ritual behavior, as though it has no value.
Well, it's had none for me. It's a very personal thing. Uh-huh. I've seen lots of ritual behavior with no ethical behavior.
Of course.
And... all right. I'm a cynic. I'm not a hypocrite.
I have a question. I have listened to a lot of comedy hours on TV. A lot of them say, now the Jews have been persecuted for 2,000 years. Isn't that wrong? Haven't we been persecuted for 5,000 years?
Well, the answer is yes and no. And we haven't been universally persecuted, and not with the same depth of passion on the part of the persecutors. By and large, like the golden age of Spain, I think we've lived very well in the United States. There was a golden age in Alexandria in Egypt. There have been many for decades on end. My guess is I won't live to be 120. If I live another 10 or 20 years, I will have lived my whole life in the United States without having to feel the whip or the lash of anti-Semitism. I know it's there, it's genteel, but you can live very well with genteel anti-Semitism.
I think you mentioned earlier that you had been one of the profs for peace in the Middle East. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened with that?
Well, I don't have to go back a million years, but I would say, let's see, the Six-Day War was 67.
That's right.
So that's 23 years ago. After the Six-Day War, going beyond the hubris of the Israelis, there was the feeling that now that you could bring Arabs and Israelis together. And a few intellectuals, Jewish professors on campus, organized this group, American Professors for Peace in the Middle East, would try to bring onto various campuses Israeli speakers, Arab speakers. You could then still get them to speak together. And the hopes were, but then, well, American hopes always are, with education you can solve and eradicate any and every problem. So by bringing our intellect to bear, that we could bring about an amicable solution to the Arab-Israeli problem in the Middle East. We did our work in the larger picture, in the longer scene. It was probably trivial. I don't want to call it benighted, although it may have been. We were do-gooders of a sort, and I think as ugliness, it was exacerbated in the Middle East, that the group, and it was a national group, just sort of melted away.
Speaking, you referred to the hubris of the Israelis, the hubris of the professors.
No, it was. After 67, well, first, I can have vivid recollections. I was chairman of our Jewish Community Relations Council, and these were dark days, because the Egyptians ordered the UN peacekeeping troops, which had been separating Egyptians and Israelis, ordered them out of the Middle East. They were waving their skull and crossbone flags, and this Jew, and I think most Jews, were concerned with the survival of Israel, that this enormous army of Egypt, with her allies, was going to overrun Israel. And from our community, a number of us went to Washington with delegations from around the country to call on our congressmen and senators to have them do something so that there would not be a war which we felt Israel would lose and would be pushed into the sea. All right, it did not work out that way. While we were in Washington, the war broke out, and it was over in short order. I can tell you that I was feeling hubris, because the one and only time in my life I flew home from Washington to Pittsburgh in somebody's very small private plane. I've never been in one of those before. I'll probably never be in one of those again. But at that moment, emotion overwhelmed whatever intellect I may have had. I'll tell you an anecdote about then-Bishop Wright. But in terms of hubris, it was my feeling the Israelis had won such magnificent and overwhelming victories, negotiate right then and there, land for peace. But their hubris was such that there was going to be a greater Israel. It's a long time later, and the problems haven't been mitigated. The anecdote, we were so concerned in our Jewish community that a few of us, well, actually, Lillian Friedberg and I from our JCRC called on Bishop Wright to see if he couldn't get opinion within the Catholic community to bear on our legislators in the Congress and in the Senate. We were really afraid for the future of the State of Israel at that particular point. He then directed the conversation to that he thinks so many of these things are terrible, that he thinks these Polish jokes that he has to hear about the worst thing taking place, Lillian and I are trying to talk about the survival of the state of Israel, and all that Bishop Wright wanted to talk about was eliminating Polish jokes. As said earlier, and as we agreed, many of our friends don't even know what our problems are.
That's right.
How do you feel about the conditions today in Israel with the Palestinians stoning the Jews at the Wailing Wall, which hardly appeared on TV a fraction of a second? The rest was all devoted to the...
I feel unhappy. I would like there to be Jerusalem to be a city of peace. There should be shalom. I don't like to intrude. It's their state, and I want them to take care of it. I don't think that the Israelis do a good job with their own PR. They let all the cameramen in. How many other things?
They have to.
Because they are a democracy, but this stuff is very photogenic stuff. And so there it goes. Just Bangladesh. When is the last time you saw somebody being murdered in Bangladesh?
By
Nasmin Thacker? When did you see Beirut? When the Israelis went in. You don't see Beirut. You don't see Afghanistan. You don't see the Horn of Africa. I mean, where are the pictures in Ethiopia and Somalia and the Sudan, going a little further west in Africa? But I lament. What I thought was going to be in 1948, when that state emerged, and what has happened proves that history is unpredictable.
Well, you made a good point. Their PR is terrible. There should be somebody in control of it there, some minister who does nothing but handle the PR.
But even with that, I've concluded Israel is different. It's just different. As American Jews, many of us don't want to think so. We want to equate what's going on in Israel with what would be going on in the Sudan or in Central America. But for the Christian world, that's where Jesus was born, and that's where he preached, and it's not called the Holy Land for no reason. And the various Christian religion, sects, whatever you want to call it, the Pope has a foreign policy. He still doesn't refer to Israel. It's called the Holy Land. It is different, for better or for worse. On the one hand, we think it's for better because it is a holy land. On the other hand, for worse, it's going to get different treatment, and it's going to be held to a much higher standard than the rest of the world combined.
I think we've done a wonderful tape.
Yes, it's almost finished.
And I think that unless you have a parting thought about some friends, relatives, or
no parting thoughts. No.
There's no point at this stage to ask other questions about old past associations or clubs you were a member of. I don't want to. I think we've done it. Thanks.
Good.
Turn it off.
My pleasure. Maybe someday I'll get copies.